Tomorrow, the Flood. From There Is Nothing to Fear by Santiside. Read by Sam Gabriel. Based on the works of J.K. Rowling. Chapter 7. Draco Malfoy. Thoughts and Things to Say. Draco dreamt, more than anything else, of his father. When Draco was younger, his father would simply disappear. Draco would walk from room to room, and no one would speak of him. There was an emptiness in each room and in the eyes of his family, and it was, all things considered, a remarkably mature breed of nightmare, but this summer Draco had begun to have more juvenile terrors. His father spread across red, slick grass before a herd of thestrals, or his father's head upon a spike, or more gruesome fantasies, and in each of them stood Tom Riddle. Gore upon his robes, mask broken and bleeding silver, exactly as he looked upon his return from France. He dreamt such nightmares, and then awoke to the dulcet tune of his grandmother clock, which rang out the hour of wake-up o'clock. Adults seemed to expect Draco to occasionally make mild complaints about not being able to sleep in, but these days being awake was better than being asleep. At his wash basin, Draco uncorked a small red bottle of Summerone's Amazing Cleanser, a recent French import, and poured a little onto a sponge. It smelled of roses, almonds, and garlic. He dabbed gently across his body, pouring out more as needed, then wiped with a second sponge full of water. The room's temperature and humidity were perfectly controlled, so his body was dry almost as soon as it was wet. After, Draco worked a pomade of bear fat into his hair. His mirror offered commentary, but Draco paid no attention. There was nothing it could say that he hadn't heard before. Last of all, he slipped a soft glove over his right hand, then opened a tin of dentifrice, half full of augury eggshell, pennyroyal, and crushed boar's bone. He rubbed the powder across his teeth, into all the crevices and over all the bumps, and made sure to dip a new finger into the tin each time he needed more. Sloppy people reused a finger and wetted the dentifrice, or worse, wore no glove at all and got their own bodily oils into the admixture, and careless people ran out of fresh fingers before they were done, but Draco was neither. Toothworms hadn't been a problem for anyone for a long time. The last recorded case had been in 1901, but less kind parents than his still used them to frighten children into proper oral hygiene. Hermione found them horrifying, as she well ought to have done, but insisted in any case on attending to Muggle customs, pulling string back and forth between her teeth like a bootblack's cloth, scraping her tongue, scrubbing her teeth with a pasty brush. It was like one of those ordeals that ancient people used to undergo in order to sift the innocent from the guilty. Her mouthwash, at least, was familiar, even if its back was inscribed with all manner of bizarre words and figures, cryptographic bar codes, and number sequences as bedeviling as any hermetic text, alchemical terminology like sodium saccharin, and last of all, the maddening, unknowable word linalool, which not even Hermione could decipher. Under other circumstances, in another life, Draco would have performed his morning prayers, but the old family cults were unpopular. Old families, after all, and father wouldn't dare speak of them, even negatively. Better not to give anybody another reason to think about his family's storied history. These days, the Malfoys emphasized old marriages to prominent half-bloods and a variety of business deals, the most recent of several familial climbs from, not pauperhood exactly, but something less than noble wealth. Better to be thought nouveau riche than ancien régime. But good riddance to the cults, anyway. Draco had heard a few stories from the black side of the family, horror stories, really, full of cannibal stars that stole children when they made noise, and the Malfoys probably hadn't had much better traditions. He remembered vaguely a legend that the manor housed a vicious gorgon, who slept behind the walls but would reawaken if someone unworthy of blood were to cross the threshold. But however horrendous these things might be, and they were horrendous, Draco rankled at the thought that he hadn't been afforded the choice to reject them or to redeem them for himself. Before he dressed himself, Draco rubbed a little ash on the inside of one cuff, then blew it away. There was, if Draco's eye did not deceive him, still a trace of the ash. Hardly anything, and yet, holding the sleeve close to the light of his wand, it was undeniably there. With a groan of frustrated disgust, Draco cast it to his bed, then drew another robe from his wardrobe. That one, at least, passed the test. A faint mark was nothing, and it was everything. The first enchantments to fail were usually those that intended to prevent little smudges. Let those fail, and then there'd be flu blots and loose threads and potion stains and strange smells. It was a little better than going naked, really. By the time that the breakfast bell rang, clear and resonant, Draco was ready for the day and halfway down the stairs. Hermione came next, visibly harried by poor sleep. "Good morning." "Good morning," they exchanged, rote pleasantries almost covering her fatigue. Father came next, newspaper already in hand, and acknowledged them with a nod. Breakfast was simple and light, a soft bath bun, with a dish each for butter and elderberry preserves, and one half of a plain baked pear. At Hogwarts it was well and good to eat up, but it felt unseemly at home to have a muggle's breakfast, full and hearty as if they had to do hard work. There was black tea to drink and coffee for Hermione, who liked hers blacker and bitterer than any espresso that Draco had ever tried, with little water and less milk, and she used cow's milk at that. It was quiet, too. Father read the Daily Prophet, talking little, exaggeratedly focused as he had been all summer. Draco preferred to not read anything, least of all the Prophet, with all its talk of war, crime, hope, and legislation. He would choose to think very little about anything outside of Wiltshire, if he could get away with it. The paper was probably an excuse to avoid talking with Hermione, who had taken the silence in stride as soon as she understood that nobody would object if she, too, brought reading material. Today she had laid claim to a stack of volumes from Abstracts in Wizarding Law of the mid-17th century. Columba had recently begun to take advantage of the new status quo as well. She hadn't even waited until she was at the table before she started to read, and just now she was laughing, softly, polite enough, at least, to not be loud, at one of those moving picture books that she liked. This one belonged to a series of Belgian comics by Jean Beaupigeon, whose characters were always cursing each other through the panels, bludgeoning each other with their speech bubbles, and desperately scheming to get one over on all the rest, a complicated affair, since they were all capable of reading their own comic to know what would happen next. Behind her rampart of books, Hermione was thinking about something. She had that look on her face, the furrowed brow, and the way that her eyes weren't quite focused on the pages in front of her. Draco wished, more strongly and more often than he ever had before Hermione arrived, that he was a Legilimens, but mental magic was taught by the headmaster, so that was right out. He didn't need classes to know that Hermione's circumstances were stressful. Torn from the country and school that she knew, bereft of her old friends, far from home, and with no way to know when any of that might change. And burdens shared were burdens lessened. Draco could hardly help her if he didn't know what needed helping. Mother, of course, was not present. No doubt she was taking breakfast while she received the morning estate report from Alvy, projected yields, accidents and misfortune, market prices, etc. She had always taken leave with regularity, but Draco felt she had absented herself more often since Hermione joined the household. Mother was unlikely to make an appearance of any sort until at least the afternoon. After the daily business of the estate was handled, she would probably go to visit her sisters. This meant, at any rate, that it was often the case that the only two who were not engaged in reading at mealtimes were Draco and his grandmother, Yvette Malfoy-Terreur. She was a moderately tall woman, an effect that was lost beside her daughter-in-law, with hard blue eyes like sapphires, her blonde hair, for so long done up in the gravity-defying whipped poof that had been fashionable in the Low Countries when Britain withdrew from the world, was now braided into the nautiloid whirl that had since gained popularity over there. Yvette and Draco talked a little sometimes, but it was not always easy to keep the conversation going while three others sat by, quiet but for the rustling of their pages. Today their halting conversation about water polo, the real kind, with hippocampi, not that staid, mountless variation that Muggles played, was interrupted by the arrival of Wiltshire's post-elf, Sylphie. Hermione greeted her with casual warmth this morning, but her work had caught Hermione by surprise at the beginning of the summer, enough to pose the question somewhat more rudely than had probably been intended. "Why is your mail delivered by elves? I mean, not that I..." In Hermione's defense, the post usually did still arrive by owl, but Mother was a member of the Wizengamot, for whom howlers were sometimes the least horrid thing found in the day's mail. There were other security procedures as well, but ever since Gormley Agormley was blown up and popped by a cursed parcel, the Office for Elvish Welfare and Labor had employed a team of post-elves to examine all incoming correspondence and packages for high-ranking ministry officials and members of the Wizengamot. The process went normally at first, as Sylphie distributed the post, and then...
"Package for Miss Granger. Pardon me, Miss Malfoy."
Grandmother grimaced. Father focused pointedly on the prophet and turned a page, a mite more loudly than necessary. Columba, if she noticed, didn't care. The name change had been processed recently, only a few days ago. Having heard it now for perhaps the first time since the parchment work was finalized, Hermione looked no more pleased than her new grandmother.
"Pretend I mailed the car," she muttered,
and Draco felt grateful that Columba had little interest in French.
"So it is finished,"
his grandmother said. Or rather, she said
allons to achevé. "It is not enough to know that it was done, but that I must now hear it every time."
She regarded her pastry, still more than half uneaten.
"Ma appetite has gone elsewhere. Robin!"
she said, switching to English, and calling to another of the elves on staff as she rose from her seat.
"Send an demon lozenge to my rooms."
There was no breath of relief when she left, nothing to mark a change in the atmosphere. After a moment, Hermione asked,
"Professor Malfoy, may I see that journal when you're finished with it?"
Father said nothing, nodded, turned the page. There was no attempt at further communication, but that seemed to be enough for Hermione, who returned to her book. Draco excused himself as soon as he had finished eating, begging their leave so he could do his morning work. In the old days, before the war changed things, the estate might have been managed more indirectly. Many more house elves, for one thing, and servants to administrate them and other intermediaries. Now much of that fell to the Malfoys themselves, and to Draco's parents had ensured from the beginning that he and Columba would understand the whole operation from bottom to top. Mother and father still clung to a faint hope that if Draco or Columba displayed sufficient dedication and skill for the task, then one of them might inherit the Godleaf stewardship, and with that, the old family estate. This was the same land that the Malfoys had owned for generations. The very plot that William the Conqueror had awarded to his court wizard, Armand Malfay, as Draco had recently told Hermione. Now they merely had the privilege, the responsibility, to tend to it, and the land might be repurposed or possessed at any time, according to the whims of the ministry. Draco rather suspected, because he had developed a sense for Riddle's sense of humor, that the Malfoys would inherit that privilege after all, but via the family's newest member, Edest Hermione. She would even get the Merlin seat that Mother now had. Not that Draco begrudged her for it. Draco would just as soon disappear into anonymity if he could. But at present, that would benefit no one but himself. At any rate, for the duration of the summer months, it was Draco's charge to oversee the part of the estate that surrounded the manor. That included a personal inspection of the beasts that lived there and the charm work that kept them fat and safe. There was, as yet, nothing out of order this morning. The cattle grazing the up-and-down land, the mokes on their mokestones, the pigs in the hog bog, and the chickens alongside them. Swine and fowl provided company for and protected each other. At night, the chickens could retire to their bird-legged coop, surrounded by burly boars that kept the premises clear of foxes and blood-sucking bugbears, and in the light of day, the chickens pecked pests and vermin and drove out demons. When it came to demons, there was sometimes no substitute for a pack of albino hounds, and such a pack had in fact been leased for one of the subsidiary farms in Cornwall, but the rooster and his harem established a bottom floor. In this part of the estate, there were 25 head of pigs and 24 bodies. Cousin Nicodemus, as she had been named, hosted a second head upon her shoulder. The pigs were Wanford Lops, white-skinned and heavy-set, with low-hanging bodies and broad, droopy ears that could reach the snout and overshadow their eyes. It was said that Wanford Lopps descended from Muggle sailors that Circe transformed ages ago, doomed to feed on themselves forever as punishment for their crimes, ostensibly all kinds of harassment, but according to Hermione, in the Muggle version, their crimes were mostly just being there. Draco doubted there was much truth to the story. Most of the famous breeds in Europe had a claim to some fabled Grecian lineage, Caledonian Curlycoat, Euromanthian Native, Fian Black, but the closest that any of the godleaf pigs had gotten to Greece was probably that the biggest of them was named Eustis. Yet it was true at least that Wanford Lopps got bigger when they ate their kin. The tradition was to feed most of a sow's first litter to the runtiest one, who would grow most magnificently. Eustis himself was a little over 5 feet tall at the shoulders, with tusks like gleaming spears and a coat of coarse bristles that could turn away a sharp knife. But they were mostly docile creatures, even gentle to the chickens that lived among them. The only unfortunate thing about Wanford Lopps was that they were curious, persistent, and clever to a fault. It wasn't enough to just ward an enclosure to keep them in. They seemed to understand not just that they were being contained, but that there were particular forces at work to keep them in, and that these forces had limitations and sometimes even failed. Wanford Lopps were always testing the wards, and though it was possible to becalm them, such enchantments tended to make the pigs less vigilant protectors and more susceptible to predators and parasites. The magic didn't always take either, as if their curiosity were driven by something more than the brutish drives of the present. But the meat was very good, which made their care well worth the trouble. And these were not the only beasts to demand Draco's attention on his rounds. There were also hives of Cottingley Shipleys, a breed of fairy being exported at a very fine price. Their wings were ground to make an iridescent green pigment, their flowing hair was good for soft brushes, and their delicate skin, so thin that a sheet of it was almost transparent, adorned the humidors of fine Peruvian cigars. British stock had not been available for many years, and the most particular and sensitive connoisseurs had insisted for a decade that the cigars had become noticeably worse since suppliers had been forced to replace real English cotties with New Zealish ones. The climate, of course, was not quite right. The worst that could be said of the Cottingleys was that they were prone to mischief. It was the other breed of fairy raised here, the Scottish Malocs, that Draco did not care to care for. They had all been dewinged, for a fairy's wings were fragile things, prone to getting damaged in the confines of their enclosures. Damaged wings not only cost the farm their value, a pristine set was easily worth several times more than a set that had lost just a few scales, but could lead to injuries that might in turn fester. It was far better for everyone, even the fairies, to pull their wings just as soon as they pupated, while the wings were still soft and the joints were weak. Dewinging also encouraged them to put on weight, which was only to the good. Mulocs were no flaxen-haired objets d'art, and waiting, like the Cottingleys, they were meat fairies, delicacies in the making, bound for the silver skewers of gourmet platters, more delectable and more demanding than a common corned pixie. But for all that there were clear and good reasons for the procedure, Draco hated it. Bereft of their insectile wings, Mulocs looked so much like stocky little humans, at least after they pupated. After the morning's work was complete, Draco went to search for Hermione. His grasp of the French language was imperfect and worth refining, and Hermione appreciated having another francophone with whom to chat, especially one that respected her. His grandmother's French was better than his own, but fell somewhat short of the other criterion. For his part, Draco appreciated the opportunity to improve his facility with a second language. In any event, it was not hard to find her. It was a rare day that Draco had to do more than guess whether to first look in the Pendle Library or the other library. This time it was the latter. Strictly speaking, there was just the Septimus Davidus Pendle Library, which, like the library at Hogwarts, was closed to the public but available to scholars and other persons by prior appointment, and a much smaller unnamed room that held the entirety of those books that the Malfoys had retained as personal possessions. There was little of actual value in the latter, but its books drew Hermione's attention as much as any others might. It was cozier as well, with three largish armchairs and the warm glow of many fairy lights. By the time that Draco arrived, Hermione had set aside her law books in favor of shockingly lighter reading material. "I didn't think that you read comics, let alone studied them," Draco added, having caught a glance at the roll of parchment on her right. "Did Columba get you into that?" Hermione was rather taken with Columba. She occasionally mentioned having a younger sister of her own. "Something like that.
She wanted some assistance learning French, how to read and write it anyway, so I'm writing a guide for her so that she can compare and contrast the English and French language editions of these albums, as much as I can anyway. They don't really stay put or say the same thing, but that's what makes the project interesting. She paused, muttering French obscenities like some people said filling the empty air by turning it blue. I should write to Fleur, to see if there are any students at Beaubaton who might like to be her pen pal, her parchment partner, she corrected. I could have helped her, Draco said. Or grandmother could have done, for that matter. Hermione shook her head, smiling. I don't think she actually wants to learn the language. She just wants to read that comic book of hers more quickly, she said. The English translation's already here behind, apparently, and she's impatient to see Beaubaton killed or something like that. Draco frowned and considered how to put it in French. Ce n'est pas Beaubaton qui dessine. Isn't Beaubaton the one who draws the strip? He dies in the comic, I think. He's also a character playing himself, Hermione tried to explain, gamely following the linguistic transition. The villain murders him so that he can't write the part of the story where the heroes win, or something like that. It's all a little over my head, Hermione admitted. I never was much interested in comics. That brought to mind something Columba had mentioned the other day. Do they really have comics in the Muggle world? Asked Draco, and she nodded. But the pictures did not move, he continued. Draco could understand films, those moved. They even made sound, or so he had heard. But what good were a few pages of frozen illustrations? You get used to it, Hermione said. Remember, Muggles do not have anything to compare it to. Poor things, Draco didn't say. He could catch his tongue before it made trouble for him, usually. It helped that his French tongue was a little slower. I hope that my sister isn't taking advantage of you. Did you take advantage of my Muggle money last year? Don't worry, I'm being compensated, and it's nice to talk with her. Hermione stilled, then sighed. Are you all right? He didn't ask, because she wasn't. What's wrong also seemed in some way the wrong question. He settled on, Can I help? You help as much as you can. Her mouth wavered between a frown and a smile. Don't take this the wrong way, but you're a good friend. But I would rather that you weren't my whore of a brother, even by law. Draco paused a moment to work that one out in his head. Tu es un pour moi? Tu n'es pas pour moi pour des frères? He didn't take it the wrong way, but that would have been easier if Hermione didn't treat whore as a filler word. At least she swore differently in English. If that's the only thing that needs fixing, then you could always try poison, Draco suggested, since you're a Malfoy and all, you know. Hermione laughed, and her expression finally settled into a smile, however small. Fuck a tick, whore. For what it's worth, of all the places that the Ministry could have sent you, I'm glad that they sent you here. And not just because I can practice my French with you. I appreciate that, too. Your father may be fluent as well, but he's always making himself scarce when I'm around, Hermione said, grimacing. Saint shit, it is nearly enough to make me want to converse with Yvette. She has not called you a... Draco paused. Grandmother has been acting civil, at least. Hasn't she? It was an indisputable fact that she hadn't been, of course, but Draco wasn't sure whether Hermione had picked up on most of the subtler ways that Grandmother had been unconscionably rude, an awful lot of which had been esoteric things like talking while she cut her salad. Yvette hasn't called me a mudblood again, if that's what you mean. She minds what she says, Hermione said, which was a generous interpretation of recent events. But you've seen the awful way that she looks at me. Your mother actually checked to make sure that she hadn't given me the evil eye. Merlin, Hermione, I'll talk with her. Do you think that'll do any good? I mean no disrespect to your mother, Hermione said, which must have been true because she briefly followed Draco into English to say so. But she wasn't able to put a full stop to it, whore. Mais elle n'a pas pu l'arrêter, pourtant. One of my mother's sisters married a Muggle-born, and the other spent time in prison for murdering purebloods. Grandmother doesn't think that my cousin is, you know, a part human. Subhuman, you mean? Draco tried not to bite his lip. Right. But what I mean is, even so, Grandmother doesn't hold my mother's side of the family in high esteem.
I would say that's one thing to thank Riddle for. But I somehow can't muster the gratitude to do so while my parents and sister are still halfway to being classified as disgusting sacred beasts. It's for their own protection, isn't it? Draco said, his mouth going a hair too quickly for him to remember just who he was talking with. I mean, you know, he struggled. They're better off with their own kind. Temple of shit, they're not a different goddamn species to be just because they can't use magic, Hermione snapped. Hogwarts takes goblins and vampires for Morgana's sake. But they have magic, Draco pointed out. Kiss a sword and kiss the lady. Wait, no. Baison et Pierre. Hermione was speaking rudely, which was to say that she was speaking French with an angry tone, so bears probably meant something different these days. Draco, my parents aren't any stranger than a vampire just because they couldn't cast a spell to save their lives. It would be like saying that werewolves are too different to us because they transform into wolves once a month. But they are too different to us when they transform, and then they're wizards again. What about muggle werewolves? She asked, and Draco was caught off guard, so she continued. There are not a fucking lot of them, but they exist. They do? There was... Hermione made a face as she tried to remember and resumed her explanation in English. Isabella Lovegood. 8 or 9 years ago, in 1986. Professor Lupin told us about her. She fell in love with a muggle, Garrett Campbell, some name, and she wanted to get around the anti-fraternization laws, so she bit him. That was extremely foolhardy of her, Draco said. Wizards were more likely to survive a werewolf attack, in part because they could better treat their wounds, and in part because werewolves were more likely to maul than murder a magical victim. But when a werewolf hunted muggles, it meant to kill, not to afflict. What possessed her to do that? She loved him. Or thought that she loved him, Draco differed. Even if she had known him for any length of time, he couldn't have known her, not really. Secrets poisoned a relationship like a corpse in well water. That's another reason that we really shouldn't get involved with muggles. If we had to obliviate every muggle who'd reacted badly to learning their fiancé or spouse was a witch or wizard, there wouldn't be time to do anything else. But that's how it worked before, Hermione cussed and then said, I think that you're losing the plot. Right, something about muggle werewolves, Draco said. The Ministry couldn't have destroyed them. You said that there are still some, didn't you? 10, I think. Most of them were bitten before the war, when living as a tramp was better than living among wizards. If it was hard enough for Draco to imagine a muggle entering magical society now when werewolves formed a stable community protected by the law, it was wholly impossible for him to imagine how difficult it would have been to do so in those hard times before. Where do you hear about such things? I took werewolf studies, remember? Hermione said, and yes, he could recall something to that effect now. It wasn't a subject that particularly concerned him. Lovegood was sentenced to 40 years in Azkaban. Draco shuddered. Small offences might call for a stint at Azkaban if they were repeated, but these days it was largely reserved for the worst crimes and the worst criminals. Even some murderers were going to be let out after 15 or 20 years. Unless it was thought they would be a danger to society, Draco wanted to tell himself that Lovegood was still lucky that she would have been killed, not incarcerated, before the reorganization. But, Azkaban. The longest detention he'd served with any of the Discipline Masters was 30 minutes, and that had been 29 minutes more than he'd needed for the lesson to sink in. They tried social amalgamation with a muggle, and for spreading lycanthropy to somebody without their consent. Lovegood tried to get the second charge dismissed by saying that she'd told Campbell about what she wanted to do, but then they charged her with breaking the statute of secrecy and said that a muggle couldn't consent to becoming a lycanthrope anyway. Of course they can't, Draco said. He wouldn't have known anything about what he was getting into. They let 6-year-olds become werewolves, Hermione said. Are you telling me that a goddamned 25-year-old muggle knows less than a child? That obviously isn't true, Draco replied, generally at least. But a werewolf's child has lived among werewolves. I wouldn't want Columba to get the nip, and she's hardly 12, but she wouldn't have understood what it means either. And I'm sure he regrets it now. Of course he regrets it. His girlfriend is going to be in prison in Azkaban of all the godforsaken places boarded in Mount Christ for another 3 decades. And she's only getting out that early because some members of the Wizarding Gamut lobbied for her sentences to be served concurrently, and his family and friends all think that he's dead. He got the same treatment that they hand to muggleborns, Hermione noted. The official story is that Campbell died on a camping trip in the Cairngorms.
That was the Muggle story? Hermione frowned, but nodded.
You see? Draco said. We're not meant to mix.
It only happened that way because your fucking government made it so!
Do you really think it's any better for him to talk with them, to talk with a whole world of Muggles, and have to lie to all of them every day? Draco said. A witch's children will probably be witches and wizards themselves, even if she's married to a Muggle. He'll have to lie to the rest of his family about the most important parts of them, where they go to school, and how they're going to make a living, and the children, they'd be born into the lie, not even given a choice about it.
Maybe.
Maybe what? Grindelwald was right. Even as a joke in private, Draco couldn't help but hush his voice a little, and he was pleased, satisfied, contentedly deconcerned to see how quickly Hermione shook her head.
There is an entire world to show us that there is an alternative, that there are many alternatives between Riddle and Grindelwald. We don't even have to talk about Muggles in order to think about alternatives to Riddle's platform. Werewolves are at the front of opposition to the Wand Proficiency Act, actually.
The what?
The Wand Proficiency Act, Draco, she said. As if he'd remember, after she just repeated the name, Crispin Hawkworth. Do you know who that is? She asked, and Draco nodded.
Hawkworth had been one of the old family purebloods who'd realized early on which side of the war were going to be the Chudley Cannons before the violence had even started, and had consequently done very well for herself. Her son might even be granted her Merlin's seat when she died.
Hawkworth wants to make squib testing mandatory by the age of 7, Hermione continued.
There's been some pushback from other groups, Riddle too, actually, because it's not impossible for a magical child to still fail a wand test at that age. But the werewolves have been especially concerned. Once someone is bitten, it doesn't matter whether they're magical or a squib. Or even a muggle, as Campbell proved. But it isn't always safe for them to be bitten so young. Like if they've gotten black cat flu already. If there are squib tests before Hogwarts, they might exclude children of werewolves.
You really haven't heard about this? She asked.
It's been in the Prophet every Monday for a month.
I haven't so much as looked at the Prophet since the end of school, Draco said. It is also dark. Besides, if there is anything important, then I can be sure that you will mention it to me.
He leaned back against his chair. You inform me even when it is not important.
Connor, I'm sorry. Morgan, je suis désolé.
I meant it as an observation, not criticism, Draco said, though the conversation had, in fact, become a little uncomfortable. And there was an awful lot that he didn't want to think about right now, or maybe just one or two things, but they were awfully big things.
I can go and talk with my father about Grandmother, though. He'll fix it.
Only if it wouldn't trouble you.
It will be just a little conversation. I'm not afraid of conversations.
Draco found his father at work in the cauldron room, somewhere in the process of brewing Wolfsbane, which was one of a few specialty potions that he prepared for the Ministry on behalf of various non- and part-human groups. The Ministry paid a respectable fee, but the money was unnecessary. Perhaps it was simply a way to keep occupied. If there was some other reason, Draco didn't know it.
Draco waited until his father spoke. Brewing could be a delicate business, and Draco would be acknowledged just as soon as father could safely split his attention.
"Good afternoon," he said to Draco at last, and nothing further.
"I've been speaking with Hermione."
Father nodded and continued his work among the sand baths and glass retorts.
"Grandmother is being unconscionably rude to her," Draco continued. "Even Hermione has noticed it."
His father remained silent. Draco gave him space to think, and finally father said,
"Your grandmother is not really a Malfoy, the way that we are. She isn't even English, and, you know, she's Catholic, for Merlin's sake."
He quieted again, as if he himself needed to consider this as new information.
"I've been nothing but polite to to Hermione. There is, after all, nothing wrong with Muggleborns. I think that one of our ancestors, Patricia Malfoy, was a Muggleborn. Sometime in the 15th century," he added hastily.
Draco wasn't sure whether Father meant to prove that he was actually familiar with the case, or assured himself that it wasn't really all that recent.
"Though it would be easier if Hermione were half-blood,"
he admitted. Draco understood where this was going. "You won't do anything."
"And what would you have me do? Talk with her?
Tell her to be politer?"
"And when she declines?"
When Draco failed to reply, his father's eyebrows twitched.
"She has ignored my polite requests before. She will not acquiesce simply because I asked again."
"Then I'll do it myself.
Draco, please don't start trouble."
"I'll be at my most diplomatic,"
Draco said, but his father didn't look particularly reassured. Father opened his mouth to say something, to implore Draco further, or explicitly forbid him, most likely, but they were interrupted by the popped emergence of Spridgen, one of the house elves employed by the estate.
He was one of the traditional Malfoy elves, whose family had worked for Draco's for many generations, but he was not at all regretful to be doing paid work. Spridgen almost seemed to take some kind of delight in working for the Malfoys now, but Draco couldn't understand why. Spridgen kept the collar of his robe carefully flat, making obvious the tight, purplish mass of skin that wrapped around half his neck, like a choker of poisonous worms. Draco wasn't a simpleton. He knew how his family used to treat house elves, but elves had long lifespans. It wasn't too much to hope, he hoped, that someone else did that to Spridgen, a great-grandfather or a distant aunt, someone that he doesn't love. But he knew, too, that his parents had aligned themselves with Riddle as pragmatists, not believers. He hoped, but dared not ask.
"There's a guest, Mr. Riddle, at the front door, sirs,"
Spridgen said, and Father paled.
"Draco, you... I am keeping you when there are chores to be doing. Someone needs to check on the pigs, don't they?"
It was blatant enough to be insulting, if Draco had thought his father had merely been trying to keep him from getting underfoot, but he understood. He was only trying to protect Draco like Draco tried to watch out for Columba. Never mind that Draco had checked the pigs already.
"Of course, Father."
But that didn't mean Draco was going to make himself scarce on command. Around the corner and past the drawing room, Draco held back far enough that he could be down another hall just as soon as he heard footsteps or nearing conversation, but not too far to overhear. Draco was hardly out of sight when he heard the pop of disapparation, elfish magic. Hermione was curious about it, but there were precious few treatises on the subject. The old families had tended to view investigations into the matter as simultaneously frivolous and dangerous. There had been no reason to be concerned that a house elf might turn their powers against their owner's rivals, not just because that was illegal and déclassé, but because everybody who mattered had house elves of their own, who could make the difference where wizarding magic failed. Research into the magic of supposedly lesser beings would therefore do nothing but potentially reveal flaws that a wizard might take advantage of, particularly a wizard that didn't come from a family of note. For these reasons, what few studies had been performed were valuable and held close, or had been, until the Ministry had appropriated those hoards of knowledge. The door opened too smoothly to make a sound.
"Thank you, Spridgen."
Draco heard a voice like a plague. 1,000 beating, buzzing wings.
"Lucius."
"Headmaster Riddle, sir. Is there something wrong?"
"Must something be wrong for me to be present? I shudder to think what that implies about the state of things at Hogwarts, but perhaps the presence of children is trouble enough."
"No, I only meant the..."
"Of course,"
Riddle interrupted.
"I am here to check on the former Miss Granger."
"I don't understand," Father stammered.
"The Ministry regularly checks on foster children, Lucius. Surely you couldn't be unaware of this. It is important to ensure that the children are settling in properly and being well treated. It is important to the country and to me that no child goes neglected."
"Yes, the Ministry, Headmaster, but you don't work for the Ministry."
"I may be head of Hogwarts, but that position also grants me a seat on the Wizarding Gambit, which is to say, even in my retirement, such as it is, I remain a servant of the people, and I do, I argue, work for the Ministry."
"But you don't work for MAGI,"
Father said, his voice a hair's breadth from pleading.
"And you don't make this type of visit, certainly."
"You were taking an awfully keen interest in my comings and goings. For someone who spends most of his time dancing on the edge of a knife,"
Riddle observed. There was a sort of choking sound here, but the kind that bespoke speechlessness, not strangulation.
"Besides,"
Riddle added,
"owing to her unusual age and circumstances, I have taken a keen interest in the girl. I think that she would benefit from seeing a familiar face."
"Yes, of course."
The longer that their conversation went on, the more uncomfortable that Draco felt. This was not how his father would have liked Draco to perceive him. Like a fly caught in the spider's web, it mattered little that he was unaware of being observed, or that Draco already understood the precariousness of his father's situation. Something of the man's dignity still seemed harmed, and Draco, suddenly regretting that he had held back to eavesdrop, immediately laughed. Walking the butcher grounds ran the risk of encountering Riddle on his way out, so at the smoking room's fireplace he cast a pinch of flue powder into the flames, whispered, "Ronsleycroft," and stepped forward a couple of 100 miles to a more distant and overclouded at the moment branch of the Godley Farms. There was little sign of it around this part, but since the partition had gone down, there had been negotiations to import more and more diverse kinds of magical beasts. Britain was particularly interested in dragons, of course, but there had also been talk of bringing graphorns to the Cairngorms, and the first breeding pairs were due to arrive at the end of this summer. Likewise, deericoles, flamingos, and golden sheep. Draco had already inspected this area 2 days earlier, but there was no reason not to visit again, especially with Riddle. Well, diligence was its own reward, anyway. But Riddle had not departed during his redundant inspection. Draco found Riddle, or was caught, on his return to the smoking room, where the headmaster had been examining or lurking among the armored suits and taxidermied beasts as if he himself belonged to the collection. Enrobed by darkness as he was, Draco did not notice him until a bone-white mask turned among the shadows.
"Your ancestors preserved an excellent set of curiosities," he said,
as a hand reached out to but did not touch a stuffed muggle.
"I was only acquainting myself with the exhibit before I left, but I am glad to have found you."
It was impossible to really know what was behind that mask. That was the point, Draco thought, but he had briefly, recently, partially seen what lay beneath it. And he imagined that it now concealed a grin. There was surely no business that would have kept him here so long, lurking, as it were, like a trapdoor spider, or at least, Draco found it very difficult to believe that Riddle had come across him, ambushed him, it felt like, by pure accident. Among Draco's thoughts was a silver through line, a fact of the matter, a nightmare, a dread that was simply unsafe to think. Draco was no Occlumens, though he might have been adept at it had he pursued the art, and he understood the rudiments. He tried to think of other things, but like a pig to its trough, his thoughts incessantly returned to the subject of their preoccupation, always in the corner of his mind's eye.
"This will be your 5th year at Hogwarts. You will be taking your owls soon," Riddle observed. "Have you given any thought to your future career?"
"Career, sir? That's... why, sir?"
"I'm your headmaster," Riddle pointed out. "Why wouldn't I be interested in your plans? I'm familiar with all of the students under my care. Do you think that I didn't make time to speak with your sister?"
he said, and Draco felt a thrill of fear.
"Besides that, your cousin Dora speaks very highly of you. She believes that you are a very talented young man, and I think your marks support that analysis."
Draco could see where this was going. The recruitment pitch. He could see as well the appeal in having a Malfoy among the Death Eaters, and if Father was anything to go by, Riddle seemed to have a predilection for keeping potential problems close at hand. Had Riddle mentioned Columba as a sideways threat? He had to accept the invitation, of course, but it might be good to push back just a little. It wouldn't do for him to seem too eager, having never raised the topic himself. "I don't think that I have the temperament to be a Death Eater," Draco said, and he told himself that it wouldn't be so terrible. At least he would have Dora, he thought, and he shut his eyes, hoping that it would seem to just be a wince.
"I agree," Riddle replied. "I didn't mean to refer to them anyway. Besides, there are no Death Eaters anymore."
"So with all due respect," Draco swallowed and forced himself to press forward. It would do no good to be stuck in the wrong thoughts. "Aren't you currently wearing a Death Eater's mask?"
"You might say that,"
Riddle laughed. The sound of it was quiet but harsh.
"I think that your cousin could explain how sometimes faces are a mask. The reverse is true as well. You are fortunate to have Dora. Not all your family are so exemplary. Few people are blessed in that way, but Dora makes up for the shortcomings of some others,"
Riddle said.
"My own family, my original family, are all dead."
Draco dimly recalled something to that effect, at least. No mention was usually made of Riddle's family except to note their absence. He was supposed to be a descendant of Salazar Slytherin, but the facts were sometimes disputed.
It was the sort of thing that father and mother only mentioned in hushed whispers when they thought that Draco and Columba were out or asleep. "My condolences," he said softly. Draco felt far too removed from himself to know whether he meant it sincerely or had just spoken the correct words for the circumstances.
"It is all right. You could say that I made a new family,"
Riddle said, as relaxed as if he were reciting the weather.
"The rest of them, my blood family, are no more than a nightmare phantasm. It is the people that we choose to bring into our life more than the people that brought us to life who really make us who we are. I would say to look to Miss Granger. Forgive me, Miss Malfoy. No,"
he seemed to chuckle.
"We have a conundrum. To whom do we refer as Miss Malfoy the Elder? One of them is 4 years the senior of the other by a purely chronological reckoning, but the other has been Miss Malfoy for 12 years more."
The silence crept on, until Draco realized that the question wasn't rhetorical. "I suppose," he began, "that it would be less confusing for Hermione to be, you know, Miss Malfoy the Elder. It would probably require fewer explanations."
"As you say,"
Riddle agreed.
"Look to Miss Malfoy the Elder, Mademoiselle Malfoy-Lenier, if you will,"
he said, slipping into French with less of an accent than Draco himself evinced.
"Born to Muggles, raised in France, and now brought safely home to her people, where she has such a family as yourself to count upon. It hardly matters that her blood family are not our kind, because now at last they are not her family anymore."
"I don't think that she would agree with that," Draco said.
"First comes denial, then anger," Riddle mused, "but finally acceptance. Remember, Draco, the future is being built all around us. If you take too long to figure out what you want to do with your life, you may find that other people have laid down bricks in front of all the exits."
Draco wasn't sure what to say to that, so he just nodded, and hoped that bewildered anxiety was an appropriate, unsuspicious thing to feel under the circumstances. Riddle continued.
"Have you considered medwizardry? It would not be too late to take the required exams to qualify for going into healing in your 5th year, and you have a talent at potions, which would be a shame to waste some day. I am certain healing will be a mere convenience, not necessity, but that will be a long day in coming. Until then, it will be important work."
Healing did have a certain appeal, Draco thought. It was practical, constructive work. It took a lot of studying, and required a lot of exposure to, not violence necessarily, or even probably, but the consequence of violence. He got enough of that in his dreams.
"Then study hard. It will keep you out of trouble."
Riddle slipped away, without a further word. And it had been Riddle. Draco was sure of that. Or at least he was sure that it wasn't Dora, which was more important. Sometimes it was her, he could always tell. It was about her posture, a way about the way that she carried herself, precarious, diffident. Dora was never fully comfortable in anybody's skin, even her own. She said that a person had to get used to their own body, that everybody did it early enough that they didn't remember, but not her, of course, not when her skin was no more hers than any of the others that she wore. There was no trouble adapting with polyjuice, but that was because it already worked on a basis of affinity, reproduction, rather than substitution. Just as soon as he was absolutely sure that Riddle was gone, with a query to Rabat to confirm it, Draco went upstairs straight away to the first floor and to Columba's room. The door opened at his knock. Inside, the fairy lights were fairly bright, rather a bit too much so in Draco's opinion, and the window open. Columba was seated at her desk, quill in hand as she drew sharp knives in bright blue ink. The ink shared some of the same vital ingredients found in portraits, photographs, and other living images, and standing beside them on the same parchment were several animated figures. Personages with vastly simplified features and, of course, personalities too simplified to be worth the mention.
"Hello, Draco."
"Headmaster Riddle was here," Draco said, "and I just wanted...
"Of course he was. He just came by to see me, you know."
Draco's heart plummeted somewhere between his kidneys, but Columba went on, noticing not at all, jabbing with her quill a couple of scribbled figures that were reluctant to take up arms.
"Professor Riddle is no fun. I know that he must have some interesting thoughts with that funny voice of his, but all he cared to ask about was whether I was making good progress on my summer homework."
Columba frowned.
"Do you know, he said that he would tell Professor Flitwick to bar me from the dueling club if my grades fell. We haven't even reached August. I'd let him return to school." You hadn't told me you wanted to join the dueling club, Draco said, though he ought to have expected it. Only a few weeks ago, Columba had complained about the termination of honor duels in the 19th century. She thought the idea was terribly romantic. Well, you hate dueling, eh? Without discarding it, Columba shifted the parchment to one side of the desk, then began to sketch out something new. They get vicious, Draco said. They get exciting, Columba disagreed. Anyway, nothing bad ever happens in a duel. Not in any of the sanctioned ones, not at school. You saw the opening duel last year, Draco protested. Peregrine Derrick was in the hospital wing for days. And that wasn't even a mistake. Hayward did that to him on purpose. Columba shrugged. Got better. The creature beneath her hand slowly took shape, four-legged and shaggy, with a slavering maw and sharp fangs drawn with loving detail. At least talk with Neville about it. Columba was about to reply, mouth already open, when Draco added, If nothing else, I'm sure you'll find that to be exciting too. There might even be photographs. Well, all right. But if he's boring, then that's the end of that. The surviving stick figures were beginning to take note of Columba's newest project. Draco wasn't sure. Their faces were far less detailed than the beast beneath her quill, but they seemed to be getting anxious. He wished that Columba wouldn't waste her ink on such frivolous pastimes. Nothing else? Draco confirmed. Really nothing, Columba sighed. I would have thought that he could stop being my headmaster while school was out. As I know some people get so excited about him, it's awfully hard to believe that he really did some of the things that they say about him. But he was rather magnificent when he saved you from that Karkaroff fellow, wasn't he? She noted. Draco nodded and hoped that he didn't seem abnormal. That was the last thing he wanted to think about. Fingers clenched around his shoulder, breath hot against his neck, that voice above his ear and that wand end against him. Karkaroff, right, he forced himself to say, and Columba frowned. But I'm sorry, I shouldn't have mentioned it, she said, and Draco tried to shrug away the topic along with her apologies, and tried not to choke at Columba's mixed language. Did she even know what it meant, or had she just picked up on the sentiment? It's all right, he said, or thought he said, while one half of his mind was stuck on the profanity, and the other half... Columba was all right, that was an important thing, and Riddle had come to meet Hermione, and... Draco found his fingers against his throat where he could almost feel the edge of the knife again, and Columba was picking up swears, and... I should be going anyway, and, you know, check on... Anyway. He pulled against his collar, hoping that his hand has not been there too long, and the motion seemed natural. Columba watched him for a moment, then nodded and turned herself back to the parchment on her desk, slowly sliding both sheets together. Her illustrated monster licked its chops and stretched its claws. The little scriven figures clutched their knives and each other's hands. He had to admit that she had a talent, and that was undeniable. The portrait club would surely be in good hands when the Weasley twins graduated. Hermione was still in the other library, having hardly moved an inch when Draco went to find her. Yes, she spoke with me, she said. Fils patadipitant. Nobody has control over the circumstances of their birth, you know. Draco said. Besides, being unkind could come off as a little aristocratic to worry overly much about the circumstances of a wizard's birth. Not to mention, there was nothing to suggest his mother was... Well, what mattered was that... Right. She was just being generally insulting. Has anybody mentioned to you that you swear like a Jarvie? Oh, I do not, Hermione replied. They did call me goddamnit, she grunted a moment later. But damn their cousins, I really don't swear that often anymore. You swear like you breathe, Draco remarked. Of the two of them, only he seemed to think that the comparison was funny, but that might have been what amused him most. People mostly only noticed they were breathing when someone else pointed it out to them. And, Columba's picking it up, which I'd rather she not. Columba. Madeline's trousers are mine. I'm sorry I didn't come sooner. I just needed to check on Columba. Christ bled, Draco, you don't have to look after me. I'm not actually your sister. Not to mention that I am older than you. It's about being your friend and your host, not about being your brother, legal brother on parchment. You know what I mean, Draco said. The frown that had sprouted across her face didn't quite wilt, but neither did it bear hideous facial fruit. Aunt Andy had once come down with that kind of thing and had to spend a week behind a cordon sanitaire. I understand, she said at last, with a sigh as though she had given up a tenacious ghost, not hers, but one she'd held tight nevertheless.
It was nothing for you to be concerned about. He asked about how I was settling in. Don't worry, I gave you a glowing report, of course. You were out of breath. Thank you, and if you could swear less around Columba, that would be great.
The smoking room was not too far from the other library, and Draco started, suddenly alert, when he heard the fireplace light and flare. That must be Mother. He began to stand, then halted himself. Draco liked to go out as often as anybody, and he had things to do and people, or a person it was just Neville today to meet. But who did Hermione have who wasn't on the other side of the English Channel?
Do you want to help me make a delivery today? Or, you know, accompany me while I make it? I'm going to meet Neville at the Blue Bastard later.
I'd love to. Actually, I think I've been wanting to try anyway.
No, I'll show you later, she said when Draco moved to ask.
In the few seconds it took for Draco to move to the next room, Mother had already put the fire down. Her outfit was impeccable. There was not a hair out of place on her head, and her eyes were clear and hard. But for all that, there was a feeling of great exhaustion, as if she had only crossed the past 48 hours with the assistance of copious amounts of tea, and only held herself up with the force of an iron will. But that was just how Mother looked after a visit to her sister's. For a very long time, Draco only knew that his Aunt Bella had done a bad thing, a very bad thing. Later, he found out that she'd committed murder, 3 murders, in fact, with her husband and brother-in-law in tow. Later still, he came to understand that she had quite likely flicked the spark that had ignited the war. Draco didn't hold it against her. He couldn't possibly. That frail body, that skeleton that muttered and murmured and sometimes mistook him for his own father. There were times that Aunt Bella didn't respond to anything. Just looked out her window at the dandelion garden or the winged horses beyond it. And there were times that she talked with him as if she herself were still a Hogwarts student. Besides, if the amnesty held for one, then it held for all. The political crimes had all been forgiven, and the past had been rolled up like a scroll and stowed away. Aunt Bella was slowly getting better, or so said Mother and Aunt Andy. It could be that he had never seen what was there in the beginning, but it felt to Draco like a new person was growing there, holding together the fragments of the old Bella like an osteopulp might hold together its chassis of bones. Draco had never made this observation to anyone who might hear it. He didn't know how his mother and aunt would take it or what good it would do to anyone, and whether he said it or not, thought it or not, Aunt Bella would either recover or not.
Welcome back, Mother.
It was necessary, in order to be polite, that Draco ask a question whose answer he already knew.
Are you doing well?
I wish I could spend more time over there, but the estate and the seat both take so much of my attention. She shook her head. But I can't let your aunts all alone with each other. They're dreadful company and worse together. She's busy, of course, very busy, so your cousin Dora doesn't get to visit as often as she'd like, Mother said.
Draco tried not to let his breath catch, but Mother continued as if nothing were awry.
They're looking forward to the end of summer. The ministry has her working hard, of course, but she'll be able to take time away in a couple of months, just in time for...
Mother kept talking, but it was all he could do to look attentive, let alone pay attention. Dora was dating someone he caught that much. Shrines or something, Draco thought, but his thoughts were elsewhere entirely, and he had to beg off, claiming he had forgotten to secure the hog bog. Mother smiled warmly and chastised him, but softly, and Draco made his exit as quick as he could. Karkaroff's fingers, but not his, Karkaroff's breath, but not his, Dora's fingers and Dora's breath in a semblance of Karkaroff's own. That had been Karkaroff for real, eating at the high table that very morning. Draco was sure of it. He would bet his life on it. But not when Karkaroff, when Dora had taken him for a hostage. What had Karkaroff plotted? Surely something, but not murder. Just as surely, or there would have been no need for this elaborate act. Draco wasn't built for this. A war could start or stop on what he knew. Breath by breath, Draco brought himself under control. He was no Occlumens, but emotional control didn't require Occlumency, quite the inverse, really. Besides, a person only had to avoid eye contact mostly and not think about that. As soon as he felt up to the task, he turned his feet down the hall and up the steps to his grandmother's room, or rooms, as it were, because 3 had been appointed to her exclusive use. She was writing a letter in the study when Draco found her, and he felt a seat on the vermilion leather armchair opposite hers. He was willing to wait until she finished her business, of course, but she turned up her face to him almost immediately.
"Draco, what a welcome delight," she said.
Under no circumstances could it be said that Draco looked forward to what he was going to have to say next, but beating around the bush would only let it linger longer in his mind. Better to pull a thorn out all at once than to tease it. "Grandmother, you need to be kinder to Hermione." Yvette, to her meager credit, stifled her laugh.
"The little bastard girl."
Draco couldn't put an objection into words. The novel insult had left him rather speechless, but his feelings must have been evident to his grandmother.
"Draco, her parents are muggles. Do you think they got their real marriage license?"
She almost shrugged. A fraction of a movement of her shoulders, just enough to express her disdain.
"None of that matter. I'm returning to Enosu."
She might as well have pricked Draco with a needle beneath his fingernail. It would be melodramatic to say he had been wounded. There were other, deeper hurts in the world. But there was a sharp pain and a sharper surprise that tasted like betrayal. And the latter was more agonizing. His grandmother had been here since before he was born, and Draco had never really considered that she might leave. Taking for granted not just that she was an integral part of his world, but that she understood her importance. It felt like abandonment, not much less awful than if his parents had announced that they were fleeing to Australia. "How?" he wanted to ask. Not merely how will you do it, but how can you do it? But that was a question for entitled children. "Why?" he finally asked. It was not much better, but it would have to do.
"Draco, my creature, there's nothing for me here in this backwards, upside-down country. I meant to make my peace with it when there seemed to be nothing else for me, but I will be able to get out soon. I've been writing to my cousin since this cretinous government allowed personal correspondence, and my niece is willing to put me up as soon as I go. They declared me dead in absentia years ago, and carved up the estate. But it will be better than living here. Mark my words."
"I didn't know that you were preparing to leave."
"It was not something that your father needed to know about."
She pressed her seal against the wax, then set the envelope aside. Her eyebrows rose as if an idea had just occurred to her.
"You should come with me. You will love the hill country, my creature." He rather doubted that.
For all that Britain had its flaws, the pragmatic union had its backwardnesses.
"There are girls that you might like also," Yvette observed. "You do have nothing to your name. Do not mistake this place for your home. It can be taken away from you with the stroke of a quill. But that is all right. Malfoy is still a good name, just as it was in my day, when I married your grandfather. We can find a girl who comes from some newly arrived family with more money than nobility. You will complete each other like bread and wine."
"You're talking about a business arrangement," Draco said. "I don't want to spend my life with somebody that I don't..." Love wasn't necessarily necessary, though Draco hoped for it. Not everyone could have a marriage like the one that his parents had, but he couldn't see it and grow up with it and then not want something like it. "I want to marry someone that I care about." His grandmother put a hand on his shoulder and bestowed him with a wise, long-suffering look, the sort that Draco felt must take many decades to perfect.
"Don't concern yourself with that, my creature. Cold hands will warm up if you hold him by the heart and wait. And the same is true of relationships, but hot ardor and hot soup. This cool over time, it is more important to need each other."
"What about Columba?
She's a girl with no money, and therefore nothing of worth to bring to a husband's good name. It pains me to say so," she said easily. "But the future may be brighter here. Certainly it may be better than in Eno. Here, where even a bastardess can be a Malfoy."
"Cannot say such things," Draco said again.
"Not here," she agreed. "But soon we will return to the hill country."
It wouldn't be a sorry life that he would go to, as his grandmother saw things. Draco had come to realize that Yvette Malfoy had been rubbed, raw, and bleeding by this existence which she never imagined that someone might subject her to. Not just the sudden and seemingly irrevocable separation from her country and family, but life amid treasures that were once hers, and now belonged to no one or to everyone, which was the same thing in her view. Before she separated from Abraxas and returned to her relations on the continent, this estate had been, as a limb of the family that held it, her possession. The house elves had been sworn to her house, and a few to her service in particular. Her husband and then her son had held a seat on the Wizengamot. Now these halls were owned by the ministry, and her son and daughter-in-law were mere custodians thereof, employers, rather than masters of house elves. And the seat, which once would have been held by her son, and later still would be held by her grandson, was now held only by her daughter-in-law, and there were no illusions that Draco might inherit any of it. The idea had its temptations. With one word of assent, Draco could pass from Britain to the continent and let a future unfold therefrom. He could secure entry to at least one of either Beauxbatons or Durmstrang, but a complete magical education was hardly necessary if he were simply going to trade on his name. There are exams he could take in order to get the right certifications. But he couldn't possibly do it. As much as it hurt him to know that, for all this time, his grandmother had yearned to be elsewhere, anywhere but where her grandchildren lived. Thinking about her feelings in those terms was perhaps uncharitable, but that was how the thing felt to him. His parents and his sister would be that much more hurt, even destroyed, to know that he had left them, abandoned them so easily. "Do you love me?"
"Bottomlessly, my creature."
"Then you'll be nicer to Hermione." Yvette looked quizzical. Her eyebrows raised slightly and a small frown below her nose, as if Draco were speaking some barely comprehensible Muggle dialect. "The headmaster came to inquire about her situation today, you know." Her frown deepened. "If he finds out how you've been treating her..." He watched the threat dangle, too uncomfortable to actually give breath to the implication. Finally, she replied,
"I will have many preparations to make before I can leave. I may have to take my meals at odd hours."
It was little, and Draco was not sure that it was actually enough, not in a way that mattered. Being respectful wasn't just a matter of not being disrespectful, but it would have to do. Not long after noon, the other chore of the day was ready to perform. Father had completed a rack of potions for Hedgeflower, and Laceflower, the local apothecary. They were rather too heavy for an owl, at least without charms, and most brewers preferred to apply magic to a potion only when necessary, and the trip would not be long, so it fell upon Draco to walk down to Wishby on Oddford and make the delivery in person. Draco checked back on Hermione. She had finally moved, albeit to the Pendle Library, where she had returned to her study of pre-modern wizarding law, and let her know that he was about to head down to the village. He had to wait only a few minutes before she was ready to accompany him with a bookmark in her book and a bulky envelope in her hand. Wishby wasn't really there until the ministry established it as a designated magical district, but it's still an historically valuable site, you know, Draco said as they walked down, before he explained its historic value to an appreciative audience of one French-raised Muggleborn. But after that, of course, not much happened until the ministry issued its charter in 1984. The place wasn't much to look at, not like Hogsmeade or Godric's Hollow. Wizards in this part of the country still enjoyed their privacy, and Oddford was not so great a river that it caused any trouble for apparition. There were a handful of permanent establishments here, mostly because they had to be somewhere, but it only really felt like a town on Wednesdays when pop-up traders put down the proverbial tent spikes all around. The village wasn't unusual in that respect. Thursday, Friday, Saturday, if there was a day of the week, then there was a town for dealers and provisioners of all sorts to visit. Cross-island travel had never been out of the question, but this was certainly more convenient. Draco wished that Ginny's family would swallow their pride and move out here. That would be more convenient, too. It would be nice to be able to encounter her on accident, quote accident, end quote rather, and not just in furtive flu chats. The really valuable thing was that the whole area was barred to Muggles, not just unplottable and warded in a dozen other ways, but actually forbidden by their own government. It was another space where the free practice of magic was truly possible, nothing to compare to the larger, older settlements, and yet, in the old days, a wizard roaming the wilderness might still be caught unawares by a day-tripping Muggle, and it would be considered his fault, not the product of sorry happenstance. There were more and safer places now. After Draco dropped off the potions at Hedgeflower and Sea, he followed Hermione to the post office, where she handed her envelope to a tawny owl. He had expected it to be another letter to Fleur or one of Hermione's other foreign friends, but the envelope was addressed to the post office at Godric's Hollow. "Who do you know that lives in Godric's Hollow?"
Draco asked, if you don't mind me asking.
Nobody really, Hermione said, but if the postmaster receives a parcel, and inside it is another parcel, and that one is correctly stamped and addressed, then he is supposed to send it out again. After it is redirected a few times, it will finally go to one of my friends in Hispanopule.
You're trying to avoid the censors?
I don't think it will actually work, she admitted. Even if it did, I could hardly find out. They'll catch the incoming post at least, and work it out from there. But it was the thought that counted, Draco observed. Little acts of resistance where the big ones were impossible. If nothing else, they kept the cutlery well wetted. There were a number of things that a community could not go without if they were going to establish themselves in the long term. Post offices, apothecaries, imprimaries, another was a staging inn. Or the Ministry thought so, and the Ministry were willing to support a few inns while they got on their feet, so the Ministry's thoughts were the thoughts that mattered. Every district's staging inn modeled itself after the Leaky Cauldron, a place to eat, somewhere to kip, and a figurative portal to the rest of the district. Some modeled themselves too closely, in fact. The inn at Ashstead had abandoned any pretense at creativity and called itself the Cracked Kettle, but Wishby upon Oddford had better luck than that, and their own staging inn was called the Blue Bastard. It was possibly a political declaration. Bastards were among those beasts that the Muggles had exterminated from Britain and the Ministry were now returning, but at least the name displayed some originality. It was also very close to being a rude word, from which fact Draco was not too dignified to take some private amusement. Hermione was nonplussed when, before Neville showed, Draco suggested that they get lunch already.
Neville won't mind that we're eating without him.
If I know his parents, and I do, you know, then he won't be able to get away before he's already eaten. Draco ordered wood pigeon over a bramble salad of hazelnuts, blackberries, perpetual spinach, and lazuli chard, dressed with olive oil and vinegar. Hermione ordered the cod kitchery, or kedri, as she called it.
I didn't know that you could make a kedri of cod, she said as their lunch was prepared.
They use haddock in Scotland, but the Ministry encourages the district areas to source their food locally. It's something to do with getting attached. There are incentives to encourage people to move here, but everybody would be happier in the long run if people stayed for sentimental reasons. That's the reason for the local newspapers, Hermione said, presumably speaking of the Gazette upon Oddford, which mostly circulated local interest items and small ads.
And I was surprised to see kedri on the menu. I mean, it's a Muggle dish, not so young as a beef Wellington, but still, I didn't expect to see it here. Some of my thoughts, I must have forgotten that the partition was a modern arrangement, not even as old as I am. It's pronounced kittery, sounds how it's spelled, and you can see it right there on the menu, and it's a traditional, wizarding British dish.
It can't be that traditional, Hermione insisted.
Kittery, if you insist, came from India. They caught something different over there too, actually, but my point is that kittery was completely unknown to Britain when the Statute of Secrecy was imposed. Somebody had to have introduced it afterward. Somebody who still had one foot in the Muggle world.
Hermione examined a forkful of her lunch, and switched out rice for buckwheat, I suppose. Do you know when that happened?
Kittery is country affair. Where are we going to get rice from?
British Muggles seem to have secured a rice supply.
British Muggles wrap their food in newsprint. What does that have to do with anything?
I'm just saying that you can hardly just assume that the Muggle way of doing things is a good way, let alone the best way.
They have rice or we don't, but what do I care for rice?
The Muggles have the Black Death as well.
It's more of a collection of very limited outbreaks now. Even when people get it, they hardly ever die. The influenza is more of a problem, actually.
But they still have it, Draco pressed. You know, when Nicholas Malfoy was accused of stiffing his Muggle tenants, which was never proven, I want to note, they said it was the Black Death that he'd been using because it posed no danger to a wizard.
I'm sure that he wasn't found guilty, Hermione agreed while she unfolded a square of newspaper that she'd fished from her bag.
The Daily Prophet, 28 June, morning edition. You've read that one already, Draco said.
Perhaps the passage of time will afford me a different perspective, Hermione countered.
Why do you need a different perspective on the price of fish?
You're just looking for something to read while you eat, Draco said. You couldn't get away with it if my father did not read at the table as well.
When I was younger, I would read the nutritional facts on the cereal box just to have something. Hermione admitted as if this were something embarrassing, but mostly it was just confusing. Cereal boxes were obviously for storing cereals, but he didn't have a clue what kinds of facts were supposed to be inscribed on one. Something to do with nutrition, obviously, but why? Did Muggle foodstuffs vary so wildly in quality that this corn gallon of oats or barley might not be as nutritious as that corn gallon of the same? Comparisons to his father's reading habits aside, Draco could have done with throwing her ruddy newspaper into the rubbish.
What are you reading, anyway?
I'm trying to follow the Quidditch, if you must know. Who's winning? Draco asked with undisguised interest. Our British team had not played in the Quidditch World Cup since 1978, one of the less serious consequences of the country's self-imposed isolation. And that was already a record-breaking absence, and Draco hoped that a British national team would at least reach the semi-finals in 1998, but it was a long hope. The British-Irish League had not competed against an international team, much less toured abroad, for more than a decade, and competitors were sharpened by the edge of their competition.
I don't know overall, Hermione admitted, but the hall, the lizard farts, it sounds better in Bulgarian. I bet on Christ. Have been performing pretty well.
Bulgarian? Oh, you're keeping track of Crumb. You make it sound like I'm stalking him. It's just, it's nice to see that he's all right. That I haven't totally disrupted his life.
Mother knows I'd follow Quidditch if my boyfriend played, Draco said gamely. Not that I would need the excuse.
He's not... Not that we aren't... Grail's whore. It's complicated, Hermione stammered.
Draco was about to push for an elaboration, but Hermione was saved by Neville's mostly graceful entry through the service fireplace. Hermione smiled and waved at Neville. I could never wear such nice clothes through the flu. At least not without a travelling cloak, she told Draco. But you'd never know he'd rolled through an inch of ash by looking at him, would you? Watching Neville, it occurred to Draco that the little things were what marked Hermione as an outsider, not simply as a French witch, but an outsider to witchcraft itself. Neville didn't stop to brush off the flu ash from his robes, for example, because the idea had honestly never occurred to him. As indeed it had never occurred to Draco before, well, an outsider remarked on the fact. It simply was not ingrained in Hermione as a natural law of the world that flu travel did not leave debris to be brushed off, because she was as acquainted with Muggle hearths and Muggle clothes as she was with flus and robes. There was still, and might always be, a part of her that thought it was only natural for clothing to get frayed and mussed up.
Comes back from your aunt's, Hermione said.
A puddle. Hermione, to her credit, did not roll her eyes.
I was thinking flu travel could be the most extraordinary thing. Apparition may be more convenient, but your mother doesn't visit your aunt's as if she's taking a trip out of town or even down the street. She just goes with the flu. Out of her house and into theirs, like all of you really live in one big house that happens to have the occasional fireplace for a door.
Again, outsider. I never thought of it that way, Draco said. Only a muggle or a muggle-raised witch would think it was anything special.
You're such a provincialist, Hermione replied, but there was nothing but good humor in her voice.
You went ahead and date without me, Neville asked as he took a seat.
But I thought... Draco said...
I'm taking you for a Hagrid orgy, eight, Neville said, smiling while Hermione spat more obscenities.
Was this about provinces? I was saying, I don't think that wizards really appreciate how fucking revolutionary the flu is. This isn't just fast travel, you understand. It's like pulling parts of the world together, she said, pinching together her right hand's thumb and index finger. Did you know that restaurants will deliver food by flu in Wizarding France? She said. On the Muggle side, it's mostly just pizza, sushi, and Chinese food, but if I could use the flu, I could just send a light to any restaurant in the metropole and make an order for Super Pistol, and in 30 minutes there would be a spin-proofed bowl in my fireplace.
You don't know how to use the flu? Neville asked.
But I know how.
But in France, you aren't allowed to lay long-lasting enchantments in any domicile where Muggles live, except for a few protective charms.
We don't get meals through the flu so much in Britain, Draco said, but I'm not quite sure why.
We vote that way,
for now, Neville interjected.
Hermione's expression turned iron fierce.
They're disenfranchising you.
No, nothing like that.
Something like that, Neville said.
But there's been talk of requiring people to attend a polling station, Draco explained. The idea is that the Wizarding Gamut is composed, mostly composed, of local representatives. It would make more sense to collect and count votes in the localities that they represent. Bringing everyone together could also help to turn the designated magical districts into real communities.
Special representatives still get votes from across the country, Neville noted. From some people, at least.
To Hermione, he said, does it count as losing the franchise if someone else is getting twice the franchise?
It could be said that the extra hassle would convince the Wizarding Gamut to abandon the special representatives, Draco said.
We can hope, anyway. I mean, the reorganization was largely to the good, and I'm not saying that we should bring back the hereditary seats, of course, Draco added hastily. But it wouldn't be all bad, he thought, to have a few hereditary seats. Not that Draco would want one for himself. He was happy to not have that responsibility, but still, he would have liked to have the option to decline it for himself. But it's unfair that there are special representatives, he said softly, almost whispering. My parents can vote for a representative from out of Wishby, and so can a werewolf, but a werewolf gets to send a second representative to the Wizarding Gamut just because he's a werewolf. It's an unfair system, he repeated, while Neville nodded in agreement. I don't know about that, Hermione said. There's a similar system in India, I think. Something about the caste system. Where in India? The whole thing, she replied. Then, understanding dawned on her face, and she explained, India is a single country on the Muggle side. There are similar systems for guaranteeing representation in Romania and Singapore as well. They're meant to ensure that minority populations always have a presence in the government. Romania was one of the Carpathian provinces, Draco thought, but he didn't recognize the second name. But there's no special representative for the old families, Neville said. Draco nearly choked, but Hermione seemed to think it was a joke, if not a particularly funny one, so Draco decided to pretend it hadn't been said. Romania, you know, Singapore, those are Muggle countries? He asked, and Hermione nodded. He very nearly said that it was no wonder, then, that the Death Eaters had proposed such a system, but that seemed an unwise comment for someone of his background to make in public. Accusations of Muggle influence had been levied against Riddle before, and for no better reason than base prejudice. Nothing good has come from Muggle countries, Neville said, gamely leaping the chasm of things better left unsaid, and landing upon a hill of unpleasant implications. You're in mixed company, Draco reminded him. Right, I'm sorry, Hermione, he said. I spoke carelessly. For a moment, Hermione looked as though she were about to curse or cuss or both. Finally, she said, I think that Romania and Singapore established their systems well after Riddle did, for the record, but what actually bothers me is that there aren't special representatives for centaurs and merfolk. That, at least, was less shaky ground to tread. They won't treat with hags and vampires as reasoning beings, Draco said, so how could we possibly introduce them into the Wizarding Gamut? They'll probably spend all their time proposing to outlaw werewolves or something daft like that. I don't know how it would work, but there should at least be the option. What if there's a decent centaur and who's okay with hags and vampires? Does he not get to vote just because he's a centaur? They have their own government, don't they? Neville said. Why do the centaurs need ours as well? Because your government imposes laws upon theirs. They can run their land how they like, Neville insisted. Only the land that your government has given them, and which your government might take away, like they did before. Maybe they shouldn't loose arrows on people if they don't want other people, having an opinion on where their land ought to be. Neville had a point, but Draco knew better than to get between Hermione and a righteous cause. Does that article in The Prophet say anything about who Crumb's playing next? He asked. There isn't. It hardly mentions them at all, there's just a set of international scores, Hermione explained. Most of the column is about the carefully catapults who are playing a tour across the Atlantic. It should have been the arrows, Neville interjected. Who did they play? Asked Draco. I don't know, the column's about the catapults, not the arrows. Who did the catapults play? They played whoever the arrows ought to have played, Neville said, since the arrows were robbed. Hermione, sighing dramatically and cussing beneath her breath, passed the newspaper to Draco. Hey, you can take a look yourself. Draco took the paper only after she gently shook it in her hand and reasoned with himself that there would be little to worry about in the sports pages. Even when he noticed that it had been placed among the international news, Draco told himself that he was being ridiculous. His gaze skipped lightly across headlines. Something about the price of copper, questions about the outbreak of disgruntled hippo disease in Louisiana, progress bringing back the pseudo-lion from the brink of extinction, catapulted to victory 150-0, read the headline he was actually looking for. Disappointing, and suggestive that it was just a fluke of the snitch, but a bit of motion, and Draco's eyes were drawn to a photograph in the next column over. Wizarding Gamut votes to approve Iberian trade deal. Nothing to be concerned over. Something to celebrate, even. Scottish rain for a week of Andalusian sun. But the photograph from the negotiations curdled his guts and nearly sent his lunch back up the way it had come. Fudge was much the same as always, with only a few differences to distinguish this from any other photograph of his. Rumpled hair a little more rumpled, and worry lines carved across a face that had lost some of its fat. It was nothing to warrant suspicion. Indeed, it was only reasonable that the minister might feel harried these past few months, but there was something about his bearing. A familiar illusiveness that fixed Draco's thoughts to one conclusion. That was not Cornelius Fudge. Behind his eyes, wearing his face,
That was Dora.
For the full text of this and other stories by the same author, visit the Archive of Our Own page of Call Me Saltiside. The music is Amon Ra by Dayswitch, under a Creative Commons license, with assistance from 1T1. If you would like to commission me to record a story, voiceover, or character, please get in touch with me using the contact information on my website, which is located at samgabrielvo.com. And there you can find other stories that I've read, as well as links to my Patreon page, to which I hope you consider subscribing to support me, and my Discord server, where I record things live for your enjoyment. And finally, as always, thank you for listening.